This is episode 65 of the Next Year Now podcast.
Hi, I'm Paula Davis Lack, author, entrepreneur, and expert in burnout prevention and resilience. If you want to break free from the busyness of life and truly thrive, then you need to start listening to the Next Year Now podcast with my good friend Tom Hefner.
Everything that I teach, I have to apply in my life. Meaning I will never teach, for example, meditation if I don't meditate. I won't teach the importance of regular exercise if I don't exercise regularly. I won't teach gratitude if I don't do my gratitude. So everything has to be personal, because I believe that as a teacher, you're a leader, you must lead by example.
Welcome to the Next Year Now podcast with Tom Hefner. Tom believes that if you really want to thrive at work and in life, then every day purposeful habits and practices are vital. The Next Year Now podcast will not only help you identify and integrate these habits into your daily life, but also bring you key insights and lessons from some of the most successful people in their fields. And here is your host, Tom Hefner.
Hello and welcome to the podcast devoted to helping you thrive at work and in life. The topic of habits and practices is always front and center in our discussion, but we also explore how we use these habits and practices to improve our personal development, productivity, creativity, health and well-being, business, and entrepreneurship. Today we're in for a real treat. We get to speak with Tal Ben-Shahar, one of the world's best experts on happiness. Tal is known around the world for his groundbreaking research and writing on what it takes to live and lead a happy and meaningful life. In our conversation, I'll be asking Tal to discuss the top habits and practices we can cultivate right now to improve our happiness. The most effective strategies we can implement to create more meaning in our life. How we can use his SHARP model to lead in both our personal and professional life. Book recommendations that will help you integrate the wisdom of history's greatest philosophers into your life right now. And so much more. Want to live a happy life? Research tells us that one of the best ways we can do this is to express ourselves creatively. Unfortunately, for you, for me, society and peers stomp that creativity out at an early age. So it's time to get back in touch with our inner creative. You know the one, back when you were in kindergarten. That's where today's sponsor comes into play. And that's because Tom Hefner Enterprises Training is sponsoring this week's podcast. What makes Tom Hefner's innovation training so effective is I teach you concrete methods to improve and accelerate your ability to think creatively. You'll walk away from day one being able to boost your creativity by 100 times over. If you want to learn more, then go to tomhefner.com/work. You can read all about the innovation training and consulting work I do over there. Don't take my word for it, though. Check out my testimonials and client list. I work with leading companies like Accenture, Porsche Car, and Starbucks, to name just a few. Tal Ben-Shahar is an author and lecturer. He taught two of the largest classes in Harvard University's history, positive psychology and the psychology of leadership. Today, Tal consults and lectures around the world to executives in multinational corporations, the general public, and at-risk populations. The topics he lectures on include leadership, happiness, a favorite of mine, given my background at the University of Pennsylvania's MAP program, education, innovation, another favorite of mine. That's what I do. I consult and teach on innovation, so you're really going to love this conversation. Ethics, self-esteem, resilience, goal setting, and mindfulness. His books have been translated into more than 25 languages and have appeared on bestseller lists around the world. Tal is a serial entrepreneur and is the co-founder and chief learning officer of Happiness Studies Academy, Potential Life, Mative, and Happier.tv. An avid sportsman, Tal won the U.S. Intercollegiate and Israeli National Squash Championships. Today, for exercise, he swims, dances, and practices yoga. He obtained his PhD in organizational behavior and his BA in philosophy and psychology from Harvard. Tal, thank you so much for being here, and welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you, Tom. Great being here.
We're going to dive into all things well-being and happiness with Tal in just a moment. I promise That's why I'm here, and I know that's why you're here too. But before we do, let's get to know Tal a bit more. Tal, one of my fondest memories as an undergraduate at Penn State was taking a physical education class in squash. And after the course finished, like, one of my really good friends and I, we continued to play for the rest of our time at Penn State. I don't know if we were any good, but I loved that game. I loved it even more than growing up playing tennis. And so I have to ask, when did you start playing and how did you get so good that you won the intercollegiate and national Israeli championships?
So I picked up squash. I played tennis before in table tennis, and I was a runner. And I picked up squash at the age of 11. It was really a love at first sight. You know, I loved the speed of it, the intensity of it. I loved everything about it. And I started playing at the age of 11. Within a year, I was playing 3 hours a day.
Wow.
And, you know, and that was my life. I remember distinctly when I was 16 or 15, I thought to myself, what am I going to do when I'm 30? And I can no longer play squash every day, all day. And so it was a real passion. And so I ended up playing and turning professional as well. And it was really a very important part of my life on many levels. So just beyond the fact that I loved it, I also learned many lessons about hard work, persistence, about losing, about winning. And today, you know, I have three kids, and, you know, I never ask my kids about school. I don't look at their report cards. You know, if they want to show me, they show me. If there's a problem, the teacher will let me know. Mm-hmm. But I always ask them about sports. And they're, you know, the three of them, boy, girl, boy, are athletes, avid athletes. And because I think it's so, so important on so many levels, both physical, emotional, psychological.
There are so many life lessons you can learn. I mean, my oldest son, it's been, I guess, close to 4 years now, and he just achieved his black belt in Taekwondo. And it was such a big moment for him because he's been working at it really hard. He has ADHD. So, you know, obviously you do probably know a bit about ADHD, just the working memory and executive functioning and things like that that can be challenging when you are doing martial arts and you're trying to get your forms down and all those things. We just found it was for him. And for all our kids, I have three kids as well. Now our youngest is 12 months, so we'll table that one. But it's just such a great teacher of some great life lessons, right? About goal setting and persistence, like you said, and how to lose well and how to win well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was it's interesting because my son and I just started together Taekwondo, and after the lesson last week, I was thinking, you know, this should be a required curriculum in every school. Again, the lessons that they learn there, whether it's about, as you say, about concentration, about respect for oneself or others, these are no less important than, you know, studying the three R's, you know, writing, reading, and arithmetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the other thing for him, it was just such a great way to reinforce the values that we talk about at home, you know, like you just touched on respect. You know, in our family, we talk about respect and kindness and persistence. And yeah, it's just I'm with you. I think it should be a required part of the curriculum. Tal, I want to ask, how did you start down this road of happiness? I mean, that's what you're, among other things. I mean, you've been a fantastic, successful entrepreneur, but you're known in the world as somebody who is an expert on happiness and well-being. Like, how did you start down this road? What led you to research the topic? I mean, you created two of the largest and most popular courses in Harvard School history.
Yeah, so I got into this whole field of happiness because of my own unhappiness. And I was an undergraduate at Harvard studying computer science, and I found myself, it was my sophomore year, doing very well academically. I did very well in athletics, on the team, of course. I did quite well socially, and yet I was very unhappy. And that didn't make sense to me, you know, at least from everything that I'd learned. I should have been extremely happy. And I wasn't. And I remember one very cold Boston morning as a sophomore going to my academic advisor and telling her that I'm switching majors. And she said, what to? And I said, well, I'm leaving computer science, moving over to philosophy and psychology. And she said, are you sure? Why? And I said, well, because I have two pressing questions. The first question is, why aren't I happy? The second question is, how can I become happier? And it's with these two questions that I then went on to get my undergraduate degree, my graduate degrees, asking how can I help myself, individuals, relationships, organizations, communities, increase levels of well-being.
As you went on to get your graduate degree and teach those two classes, I remember reading somewhere, you know, that first happiness class, it's, or, you know, started out small and then it grew really quickly. So something about what you were sharing and teaching others really resonated. If you think back about that experience, what stands out to you?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, the first year that I taught the class, I had 8 students. Two of them dropped out, which left me with 6 and a broken ego.
A broken ego.
And then the following year, it grew significantly. And by the third year, it already became the biggest class at Harvard. And the reason is that, you know, at Harvard, like in other colleges, students evaluate courses. And the class was evaluated, you know, got a good mark, but many classes do. However, at the end of the evaluation, there is an open space where you can just basically anything else you'd like to add about this class. And a large proportion of the students, again, independently wrote, this class changed my life.
Mm.
And as soon as, you know, that was there and it was noted in the what's called the Q guide, the evaluation guide, students were attracted to it. And the reason why, you know, when I put together a class, and by the way, any class, not just the happiness class, I also, you know, I teach leadership and personal development, whatever it is that I teach, I always have 3 criteria, you know, 3 guiding principles. The first one is that everything that I teach, I have to apply in my life, meaning I will never teach, for example, meditation if I don't meditate. I won't teach the importance of regular exercise if I don't exercise regularly. I won't teach gratitude if I don't do my gratitude. So everything has to be personal because I believe that as a teacher, you're a leader, you must lead by example. That's rule number one, principle number one. Principle number two is that everything is based on rigorous research. You know, I teach in academia. It's not a self-help new age course. It has to be based on rigorous academic research. So that's rule principle number two. Principle number three is that it has to be potentially applied. Meaning, I don't just teach because, okay, this is an interesting study. I teach because this is a study that you can take and use in your life, either today when you're a 20-year-old student or, 10 years from now when you're married and just had your first kid. It has to be applied. So these three elements work well together towards this class being not just an informative class, but potentially, not for everyone, but for many of the students, transformative.
Mm. I'm going to have to steal some of those for my, I teach classes on innovation. So you just gave me some ideas, but I'm going to file those away for just a moment. You know, Tao, one of the things that like really helps to brighten my day, to lift my mood is to go outside and be active. And you talk about the importance of moving in your book, Choose the Life You Want, 101 Ways to Create Your Own Road to Happiness. And so before I hurt my hip, that probably would have included playing squash for me. Now it's, you know, some lower impact things. But I know there's a lot of other goodness in that book, as well as in some of your newer books about ways and practices. For example, your most recent book, Shortcuts to Happiness. If you reflect on everything you've learned since then, or even on some of the important insights in Shortcuts to Happiness, if you could share 2 or 3 practices or habits that would improve our happiness, what would they be?
Yeah, so I have 101. Do you have time for that?
All 101.
Yeah, here, you know, the thing though is before I go into concrete, we can become happier in many ways. The key when introducing new practices, different things that we do, is to do them consistently. You know, so it's not doing something radical, it's not doing something extreme, but it's doing something consistently day in and day out. So here are a few ideas. The first thing is that in order to experience happiness, maybe the most important thing to start with is to allow in unhappiness. You know, there's a common misconception that a happy life is a life where one is always happy. a life devoid of painful emotions? Well, there are only two kinds of people who do not experience painful emotions, whether it's anger or sadness or anxiety or fear or envy. Two kinds of people, the psychopaths and dead people. And the problem is that when we do not allow in these painful emotions, when we say, oh, there's something wrong with me because I am sad, and look at everyone on social media, they're happy all the time. When I'm doing that, I'm adding a second unnecessary level of pain. So the first initial level of pain of sadness, anxiety, and so that's inevitable, again, unless you're a psychopath or dead. But the second level comes when you reject these emotions. And the second level is actually much more sinister, much more pervasive, and much more persistent. In other words, if I just allow the anxiety to be in me, you know, before I go on and give a lecture, or you know, the sadness when I you know, open the news and see something, if I just allow this emotion to exist without fighting it, on the contrary, embracing it, you know, in the words of Oxford professor Mark Williams, observing it with friendly curiosity.
I like that.
But yeah, I do too, because then I'm not adding to this first level of pain, a second level of suffering, unnecessary suffering. So what I've come to call the permission to be human is first and foremost the key to happiness, allowing unhappiness.
My dad called that, my dad was in the Marine Corps, and growing up, he spent 27 years in the Marine. He would tell us, you got to learn to love to suck, son.
That's right. Exactly right. So the other thing, which is, again, I'm not saying anything new here because we all know it. You know, my grandmother told me this throughout my childhood. Number one predictor of happiness, relationships. Quality time we spend with people we care about and who care about us. Now, if I was teaching, you know, 50 years ago, I don't think I would have even have had to say it. Today, it's necessary. Why? Because virtual relationships are taking over real relationships. And unfortunately, 1,000 friends on social media are no substitute for that one BFF, you know, face-to-face. Mm-hmm. So spending quality time with our friends, with our family, with our colleagues, and quality time means phone off, focus on that person. Even if it's sometimes unpleasant and it's easier to run away to the, you know, to technology, insisting once, as I said earlier, consistently, persistently insisting on real relationships. Number one predictor of happiness. And interestingly, there's, you know, a lot of research on national level happiness. Happiest countries in the world, countries like Colombia, Denmark, Israel, you know, Australia, Norway, Costa Rica. Why these countries and not others? One reason and one reason alone. Relationships. There is real focus on the interpersonal elements of life with families or... Mm-hmm. So that's second. And, you know, the third point that... I'll bring up is the mind-body connection, you know, in general. And again, there are many subcategories here. You know, one of them is, of course, physical exercise. You know, you talked about going outside and or playing squash. And, you know, we weren't made to be sedentary. We weren't made to sit in front of a computer or in meetings all day long. We were made to hunt and gather, you know, to run after an antelope for lunch or run away from a lion so that we don't become lunch. So... And this is what our nature demands. Just as our nature demands vitamins or sleep, which by the way is another important element of happiness, or oxygen. So we need to be active. And you know, there's interesting research came out recently that goes beyond just being physically active. So the one is or beyond you know, going to the gym, just movement. So this is Cambridge University, England. They show that people who move every, say, between 20 and 30 minutes, on average, are happier than people, you know, who would plant themselves down, anchor themselves to the seat for 3-4 hours at a time. So happiness is impacted by just moving around once in a while. You know, you do work on innovation, creativity. We become more creative when we get up.
Change your perspective, change your frame of mind physically, right? I mean, to physically change your perspective and get up and move.
Yes, and more blood is flowing to your brain, mm-hmm. To your heart. You know, so just movement beyond exercising on a regular basis is important.
I will yes and that all day long. A good friend of mine, Tom Rath, who wrote StrengthsFinder 2.0, he talks about, you know, sitting is the new smoking. I don't know if it's that serious. I mean, he definitely makes a case for it in his book. But I think that the more that we can move, in my anecdotal experience, the better we feel.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Tom is right. He's not exaggerating. Sitting really is the new smoking. So just like smoking can take away, you know, cut years from your life, so can sitting too much.
Yeah, I think that's the one benefit I found of my Fitbit, because the Fitbit, it doesn't count steps all that accurately or my heart rate all that accurately. But one of the things that's nice about it is it provides a nice little physical cue. It'll do a little buzz on your wrist. Oh yeah, like I haven't moved in 20 minutes. It's time to get moving.
That's great.
Over the last 10, 15 years, Tao, happiness has become a hot topic in popular culture. There are books, there are magazines, there are blogs, there are podcasts. I mean, this is a podcast that overlaps quite a bit in happiness and in positive psych. And so basically any type of medium you can think of has been devoted to the pursuit of happiness. And I think so many of us are searching for that happiness. I mean, you mentioned that earlier. So what I would say is that for all of you listening now, if that sounds familiar or you find yourself nodding in agreement about chasing happiness, then I want you to stop what you're doing and pay close attention to my next question for Tao, because I think it's a really, really important question and something we're going to discuss right now. Tao, is happiness even something that must be pursued, or do we have this endless pursuit all wrong? I mean, is it more a byproduct of something else, or am I looking at this the wrong way?
So, you know, when you were setting up this question, I thought that maybe you're exaggerating, but you weren't exaggerating. This really is a very important question. And here's why. So there's actually research by a psychologist named Moss and others showing that people who wake up in the morning and say, okay, I'm pursuing happiness, or happiness is my thing, or I want to be happy, they're actually less happy. So that actually affects their happiness negatively. It, for some reason, increases things like loneliness, increases frustration. There's a problem, though, here, because on the one hand, you know, this research is telling us, well, maybe you shouldn't chase happiness, pursue happiness. But on the other hand, we also know all the benefits of happiness. The first one being, it feels good to feel good. I mean, who doesn't want to be happy?
Mm-hmm.
Then also, we have all the research, again, from your field, the creativity levels go up when you increase levels of well-being. We know that productivity goes up, relationships improve. So there are all these benefits to pursuing happiness. And yet we're told it's problematic to pursue. What do we do about it? So the answer to this question lies in pursuing happiness indirectly. And that's very important. What does it mean to pursue happiness indirectly? It means, for example, to ask, okay, so what are the elements that make up happiness? And the elements, I have my one, you know, Marty Seligman, his has his, but the elements that make up happiness, that together constitute happiness for me, are spiritual well-being. So spiritual well-being is about a sense of purpose and meaning. Spiritual well-being is about being present to the here and now. So spiritual well-being. Then there is physical well-being, you know, mind, body, exercise, sleep, nutrition, and so forth. Then there is intellectual well-being, which is about engagement with text, engagement with nature. It's about curiosity. You know, there's interesting research on curiosity and longevity. So if we're lifelong learners, we're more likely to have a longer life.
Whew, I'm in good shape then. that's my number one signature strength on the VIA survey, love of learning.
Fantastic. So there's, you know, research on that. Then there is, beyond intellectual well-being, there's also relational, as I mentioned, the number one predictor of happiness, relational well-being. And finally, there is emotional well-being. How do I cultivate pleasurable emotions, whether it's through gratitude, whether it's through savoring, and how do I deal with painful emotions, for example, by giving myself the permission to be human. So it's these five elements: spiritual well-being, physical well-being, intellectual, relational, and emotional well-being, which make up the acronym SPIRE. These together create a happiness. Now, what does it mean to indirectly pursue happiness? To wake up in the morning and say, okay, so how can I introduce more spiritual well-being into my life? How can I, perhaps by meditation, or how can I introduce physical well-being? How about I go for a walk outside, or intellectual well-being? What can I learn today? Or relational well-being? How can I spend more quality time with my BFF? Or emotional well-being? Can I give myself the permission to be human, or can I express gratitude now? And this is about indirectly pursuing happiness. And that increases levels of well-being. The analogy that I use, or a metaphor that I use to explain this idea, is sunlight. You know, if I look at the sun directly now, I'll get hurt. It's certainly unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
However, if I break down sunlight, white light, to its constituents, the colors of the rainbow, that I can look at, that I can enjoy, then it's the same way. Pursuing happiness directly actually can hurt more than help. Pursuing happiness indirectly through its constituents, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I had a similar experience, you know, as I was kind of knee deep in my studies at UPenn with Marty and company. I was really, because I was very unhappy at the time, and one of the reasons why I ended up going to that program, I'm like, all right, I got to get happy. I'm going to find all these different ways. And then I came across a book at that time that I had never come across. And it was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Mm. And that kind of just completely shifted my perspective, and was a bit of a thunderclap moment for me to do the same thing that you're talking about, which was, look, this pursuing happiness directly, this is not the way to go. And one of the ways that I can pursue it indirectly was to find more meaning and purpose, or to build more meaning and purpose in my life. And if I built a strong enough why, then I could pursue some of those things that you were talking about, you know, whether it's spiritual, whether it's, you know, physical, emotional, relational. That was a big moment for me to kind of come across to the same, you know, conclusion that you did. It's just, I did it a different way through the imitable Viktor Frankl.
Yeah. And, you know, he's indeed such an important thinker in the field. No, I certainly consider him as one of the fathers of positive psychology, or the happiness studies field.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to pivot here and talk about leadership. For us to thrive at work, we need to be on board with leadership at some point, whether that's we are leaders or not. We're certainly working for leaders at times. And so in Tao's book, The Joy of Leadership, he discusses leadership in how we can use the latest social science findings and positive psychology insights, along with his leadership model, SHARP, to become 10X leaders. Tao, what does it mean to become a 10X leader, and how is that different from the normal leader?
Yeah, so first of all, the basic assumption of the book is that we all today need to be leaders. Because if you think about the characteristics, and I'm talking about traditional characteristics of leaders, what do they have to have? Well, they have to be independent. Those leaders have to be innovative and creative. You know, they can't just be told what to do and then do it. They have to be able to cultivate healthy relationships with others, because they have to get others to follow them or to work with them. And if you look at these characteristics, these are characteristics that are required of leaders. In today's world, they're required of everyone. Because, you know, if we have today most, and in the near future, all of the mechanical, technical work will be outsourced to robots. Mm-hmm. They'll do it so much better than we can. And the premium for being human will be creativity, innovation, ability to work in groups, and so on. So leadership will no longer be the luxury of the few at the top. It will be a necessity for all. And this is the basic idea, basic premise of the joy of leadership. That leadership is important for everyone. Now, having said that, all these characteristics are augmented, enhanced through well-being. If I increase levels of happiness even by a little bit, I will become more creative. My relationships will improve significantly. I will become more engaged and more productive. In other words, I will become a better leader. And that's why my co-author and I, Angus Ridgway, who worked, was actually responsible for leadership development within McKinsey for many years, what we found is that flourishing, happiness, well-being, and leadership in the 21st century are two sides of the same coin. They work hand in hand together. Now, how do you increase levels of well-being? By focusing more on your strengths, by learning to deal with stress through recovery, through physical exercise, through being engaged, present in the here and now, by cultivating positive and authentic relationships, and very importantly, going back to your conversation of Viktor Frankl, by identifying a sense of purpose at work.
Mm-hmm. Can you share a little bit more about what the SHARP model is and how we can leverage that to improve our leadership?
Good. Yes. Yeah. So what Angus and I did when we wrote the book and when we launched our organization, Potential Life, is we asked, what is it that distinguishes the best from the average? Not the best from the worst, but the best leaders from most other leaders. And we identified 5 leverage points. They're not the only distinguishing characteristic, but they account for, you know, statistically speaking, for most of the variance when it comes to identifying those best leaders. And those 5 areas, and they you know, I love acronyms, by the way, one of my hobbies. So just like I have the SPIRE acronym for happiness, we came up with a SHARP acronym for great leadership. And the S stands for strength, which is about primarily, not only, but primarily focusing on what one is good at, what are your strengths, and what energizes one. In other words, what gives you strength. Mm-hmm. So that's strength. Then we talk about the H is health. Health is about exercise, about sleep, about recovery and dealing with stress and so on. Then there is absorption. Absorption is about mindfulness and engagement. And again, the only reason why we used absorption rather than mindfulness and engagement was because of the acronym. It couldn't have been SHMERP or SHERP.
SHMERP, SHMERP.
Cute, but it doesn't work for a leadership book.
I like that.
Then R is relationships, of course, and that's about authentic relationships, about being real. It's about positive relationships, empowering relationships. And finally, purpose, that's the P of SHARP. It's about finding meaning. Meaning, again, going back to Frankl distinguished between the meaning of life and the meaning in life. You know, so the meaning of life, you know, one may find maybe in religion or in overcoming oppression or alleviating poverty and so on. You know, that's the meaning of life that some people find. However, you can also find meaning in life, and that's meaning in the day-to-day experiences, in making someone smile, in contributing to someone else's livelihood, in making a difference. In general, and it doesn't have to be grandiose or extreme.
There's a great story from Amy Rozneski from Yale where she talks about the work she did with job crafting, and she talks about how they were in a hospital and they were talking to various people that worked there, and they talked to the lady that was one of the ladies that was cleaning the rooms for the patients, and she was just like incredibly satisfied, incredibly found her job incredibly purposeful and held lots of meaning. And they're like, well, you know, tell us more about this. And she said, you know, I helped them heal. I helped the patients heal. Mm. Like she viewed her job, and from the outside in, it's probably, you know, a bit crass to say, but you can imagine how some people would not view it that way. And here, this person was finding meaning in life, in the day-to-day work that she was doing.
Exactly right. And again, the work on job crafting, the main idea there is that in just about everything that we do, we can find some meaning and purpose in just about everything that we do. You know, so Angus Ridgway, my partner, is he's British and with a British sense of humor. So, which, and I forgive him for that.
I forgive him for that. Him.
And one day he was talking to his brother-in-law, who's a doctor, cardiologist. And basically what his brother-in-law does is he puts in pacemakers, and every few years he takes them out and changes the batteries and puts them back in again. So Angus, with his typical humor, says to his brother-in-law, "Oh, I see. So what you do for a living is you change batteries." and his brother-in-law doesn't even smile. He just looks at him very intently and seriously, and he says, "Angus, yes, that's right. Some days I change batteries. Other days I save lives."
Yep.
Yeah. So, and again, this gets to the point, you know, what do you focus on in what you do? And we can always, and, you know, this is also work done by Adam Grant and others, you can always learn to focus on the meaning-making aspect of your work. You know, one of the interventions that I introduce in workplaces is I come in and I ask them to write their calling description, not their job description, their calling description. What is it about your work that provides you with a sense of calling? And just thinking about that shifts the focus, changes the mindset of many of the employees.
Mm. Tal, if I'm listening to you right now, maybe on my way to work, and I lead a team of direct reports, or maybe even a team of direct reports, what's the one piece of advice or insight or maybe practice you want me to know?
Yeah, so again, I have about 101 that I think are important, but let me focus on one. So just recently, Google did a study on their teams. Now, Google have extraordinary teams. You know, they're the number one choice employer. They get really good people, and they select them for teamwork as well. So generally, at Google, you have amazing teams. But they wanted to know, who are the fairest of them all? You know, who are the best teams and why? And they did very extensive research. You know, Google knows how to run analytics. And what they found was that there was one determinant of the best teams within Google, among the, you know, the thousands of teams that they had. And the one thing was psychological safety. Psychological safety is the feeling that employees or the feeling that employees have that it's okay to make a mistake, that they won't be embarrassed by, that they won't be laughed at, put down, were teams that encourage learning, that encourage asking questions, because when you're asking questions, you're saying, "I don't know." So teams that provide the safety for people to ask questions, to make mistakes, to fall down and get up again, where there is collective learning from mistakes, where diversity and difference are celebrated. This is psychological safety, number one predictor of team success. Now, this is a concept that was introduced or reintroduced by Amy Edmondson.
Yeah, she's going to be on the podcast in 2019, actually.
Well, she's incredible, and the work that she does is critical, very important for successful teams. So going back to your manager, create a psychologically safe environment. How do you do it? Well, Amy will be able to tell you in much, much greater depth and a lot better. However, just a couple of things. One is lead by example. In other words, share mistakes. Show that you're vulnerable and that it's okay to fail. You don't want yourself depicted as omnipotent, as know-it-all, and someone who does not fall down. So. Show your humanity, your vulnerability. When someone does make a mistake, don't put them down. On the contrary, say, you know, how can we learn from it? How can we grow? It reminds me, I was just watching this with my son the other day, Ben Zander, who's a music conductor. When he teaches students how to play an instrument, whenever they make a mistake, he encourages them to say, "How fascinating," so that they don't put themselves down when they make a mistake. How fascinating. So they look at it as a learning opportunity.
That's a great tip, even just for parenting.
I think first and foremost for parenting.
Yeah. Tal, before we move on to the last part of the show, is there anything else that you'd like us to know, something I haven't asked you about but you think is really important?
I just maybe to reiterate something that I said in passing at the beginning, and that is that, you know, to bring about change in your life, to become happier, you don't need to introduce radical changes. Small changes can make a big difference if, and this is a big if applied consistently. You know, this is the key. So Peter Drucker, you know, father of modern management studies, talks about how, you know, what you need to bring about change is consistency. What you need are rituals. That's the key, whether at work or at home.
You're speaking my music right now. I've quoted him several times on here. What gets measured gets managed, and so I'll yes and that and say that whatever changes you are making, big or small, you should measure them and see one, because if you measure it, you're gonna more likely stick to it. But also, you can see the results of the different, you know, hypotheses you might have and the different experiments you're running.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's time for my favorite part of the show. Tal, you've written several amazing books, so I think you'll appreciate this discussion. And this is where we talk about one of the very, very best habits we can adopt today, and that is the habit of reading. I want you to think about the books you've really enjoyed over the years, or books that have impacted you deeply. What are the two or three books that stand out for you?
Okay, so two or three. Not 101. Love of learning, by the way, also my number one strength. So, So here are a few books, and you know, first of all, a book that I think every human being, two books that all human beings should read. These are ancient books that changed our world and for the better. One is Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle. This is a book that every day, you know, if you do gratitudes, you need to write Nicomachean Ethics, because thanks to Aristotle, his book, his thought, we have our world today. We would maybe have still been in the Dark Ages without the rediscovery of Aristotle's work just before the Renaissance. It actually led to the Renaissance. So that's, you know, not an easy book to read, you know, it's not but it's a very important book. So that's one. With that, Lao Tzu, on the Tao is a very important book, especially if you read it with a psychological mindset. So you can read it when it comes to ethics and leadership, but especially if you read it with a mindset of how should I lead my life on the emotional level. Many, many important lessons there. I often cite it and use it in my teaching. Okay, moving on more to modernity. My favorite living philosopher today, my favorite living author today, Alain de Botton. You can't go wrong with him, whether you're reading him on relationships, whether you're reading him on the architecture and happiness, or the consolations of philosophy, or how Proust can change your life, or art as therapy, or about sex, or about religion for atheists. You can't go wrong with Alain de Botton, you know, to my mind, the greatest living thinker. So anything by him. Another thinker who really influenced me a great deal over the years is Nathaniel Brandon.
I don't think I'm familiar with him.
Yeah, so Nathaniel Brandon was considered for a long time the father of the self-esteem movement in the U.S. and the world. And he wrote his best-known book is The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. I wrote my dissertation on his work.
Okay, very cool.
And again, an author who's read by many people today, Yuval Noah Harari, Sapiens. And his latest book, which I'm reading right now and loving, is 21 Things for the 21st Century.
All right. I've got some Amazon book buying to do today. final question. What are you working on now, or what do you have coming up that you're really excited about?
So 99% of my time I'm spending now on the Happiness Studies Academy. And the Happiness Studies Academy was born, at least in my mind, a few years ago when I was on a transatlantic flight, and a question suddenly came to me. And the question was, how is it that there is a field of studies for biology and psychology and history and medicine and education and geography, and there is no field of studies for happiness? Yeah, there is positive psychology, which is my field, but that's just the psychology of happiness. What about the philosophy of happiness? And what about what economists had to say about happiness and historians and theologians and the neuroscientists? So I resolved then to help create a field, or rather an interdisciplinary field of study that looks at happiness, that brings together history and biology and neuroscience and psychology and philosophy to shed light on perhaps the most important question that perhaps most people have on their mind, is how can I increase happiness or level of well-being or reduce suffering in my life, in my family, and in the world? And the Happiness Studies Academy brings together these fields and offers certificate programs, shorter programs, and very soon also degree courses in this field.
Very cool. If we wanted to learn more about that, where would we go?
Well, you can go to my website, talbenshahar.com, or to happinessstudies.academy.
All right. We'll definitely include that in the show notes. Tal, that's all I have. Thank you so much for being here today. Thank you for this amazing conversation. I'm taking away lots of concrete things, as well as some principles that I'm going to adopt in my life, and I know the rest of us are as well.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thank you for doing the work that you're doing.
This is just a reminder that today's episode was sponsored by Tom Hefner Enterprises Innovation Training. If you're interested in improving your happiness, then one of the ways to do that is to improve your creativity. There's no better way to do this than learning how with this innovation training program. Head on over to tomhefner.com/work to connect and learn more. You can connect with Tal online through his website, www.talbenshahar.com. That's TalBenshahar.com. All the links and resources Tal and I discussed can be found at the page created just for this episode. You'll find it all at nextyearnowpodcast.com/65. And finally, just a reminder, if you like the show and enjoy learning from our guest each week, please consider giving us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us to stay relevant and findable by listeners like you. That's it for today. I'll see you next time.